You're listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Boston College. Today is Sunday, May 17, 2026. Step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear tonight belong solely to our hosts and guests. They do not necessarily represent the views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This Week in Palestine is a place where truth does not arrive quietly. It does not tiptoe. It does not bow to power. Here, truth enters the room with its full weight, untrimmed, unsoftened, unafraid. Here, urgency is not a mood. It is a living pulse. Here, clarity is not a luxury. It is a responsibility. And while our compass points toward Palestine, toward the West Bank, toward Gaza, we also bring you stories from across the world. Stories that may seem distant at first glance, yet ripple outward and shape Palestinian lives, shape the future of Palestine in ways the headlines rarely acknowledge. Wherever you are, driving through the long stretch of night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home. Thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. On this program, we do not smooth the edges of reality. We do not rewrite the story to make it easier to swallow. We do not trade honesty for comfort. This is a space where truth arrives unfiltered, where resistance is lived, not imagined, where solidarity is not a slogan, but a legacy carried through generations. This is where voices rising from occupied land are not faint, not isolated, not swallowed by the machinery built to silence them. They rise together, steady, unbroken, standing beside movements across the world that insist on dignity, justice, and liberation for all people. This hour is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance refuses to fade. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften. We do not dilute. We speak with intention, because the stakes are far too high for anything less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. Because the struggle for liberation does not belong to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared, it is global, and it is sacred. Now, let's talk about newborn babies entering the world. There are moments in global politics that don't arrive with explosions or speeches or breaking news banners. They arrive quietly in a single message, a single sentence, a single line that cuts deeper than any diplomatic statement ever could. A line that exposes the truth behind the power, the grief behind the politics, the humanity behind the headlines. Today, we begin with one such moment. A newborn child, a proud mother, a congratulatory post on social media, and then a reply from a nation. A reply that shook the internet. A reply that carried the weight of 168 dead children. This is the story of how Iran congratulated Donald Trump's spokesperson on the birth of her daughter in its own way. Caroline Levitt, the White House spokesperson for President Donald Trump, posted a photo celebrating the birth of her newborn daughter. A moment of joy, a moment of innocence, a moment every parent understands. But in the world of geopolitics, innocence is never untouched. Because beneath that photo, beneath the congratulations and emojis and warm wishes, came a message from the Iranian embassy in Armenia. A message that did not congratulate her in the way she expected. A message that said, "Congratulations. Children are innocent and beloved. The 168 children your president killed in the Minab school and you justified were children too. When you kiss your baby, remember the mothers of those children." A message that turned a celebration into a confrontation. A message that forced the world to look at two images at once. A newborn child and a school reduced to rubble. To understand the weight of Iran's message, we need to go back to Minab in southern Iran, to a school that became a grave, to a strike that killed 168 children. The Iranian government has repeated this number again and again, 168, not soldiers, not militants, children. Children who were sitting in classrooms. Children who were learning, laughing, drawing, dreaming. Children who never made it home. And Iran says the United States was responsible. Whether you agree with Iran's framing or not, whether you believe the numbers or dispute them, one thing is undeniable. The grief is real. The mothers are real. The loss is real. And Iran chose this moment, the birth of a child, to remind the world of the children who died. Diplomacy usually speaks in careful language, measured, coded, sterile. But this message was none of those things. This was not diplomacy. This was a dagger wrapped in a congratulations, a dagger aimed not at a mother, but at a government, at a policy, at a worldview that Iran believes treats some children as precious and others as collateral. Look how the situation captures this moment with dramatic clarity. It frames Iran's message as a moral confrontation, a reminder that motherhood does not exist in a vacuum, that politics does not stop at the nursery door. And the question Iran posed implicitly, painfully, was this: how can a mother celebrate new life while defending the killing of innocent children? There is a reason this message went viral, a reason it spread across Arabic media, Iranian outlets, and Western commentary, because it exposed a contradiction at the heart of global politics, the contradiction between personal innocence and political violence, between the joy of one mother and the grief of many, between the image of a newborn child and the image of a destroyed classroom. Iran's message forced the world to hold these two images together, to feel the discomfort, the tension, the moral weight. And that is why it struck so deeply. And let's pause here. Let's imagine the mothers of Minab, Mothers who sent their children to school that morning. Mothers who packed lunches, tied shoelaces, kissed foreheads. Mothers who waited for their children to come home and instead received silence. Iran's message was not just political. It was maternal. It was a reminder that grief does not disappear because the world moves on, that the death of a child is not a statistic, that every mother, everywhere, understands the same language, loss. And Iran used that language, deliberately, painfully, to confront a spokesperson who defended the strike. The question that refuses to leave, even after the conversation ends: how can a mother accept the killing of innocent children? It is not a question for Caroline Leavitt alone. It is a question for every government that wages war, every official who justifies civilian casualties, every spokesperson who sanitizes violence with language like precision strike, collateral damage, or unintended consequences. Iran's message stripped away the euphemisms. It replaced them with a newborn child and 168 dead ones. Motherhood is often used in politics as symbol, as shield, as moral authority. But here, Iran flipped the script. It used motherhood not to soften a message, but to sharpen it. It said, if you celebrate your child, then acknowledge ours. If you feel joy, then recognize our grief. If you defend your government's actions, then confront the consequences. This was not a geopolitical argument. It was a human one. And that is why it resonated. The reaction online was immediate. Some called Iran's message cruel. Others called it honest. Some said it crossed a line. Others said it revealed one. But everyone agreed on one thing: it could not be ignored. The shock, the discomfort, the moral clarity. It framed the moment not as a diplomatic spat, but as a confrontation between two truths: a mother celebrating life, a nation mourning death. And the world was forced to choose which truth it felt more deeply. In the end, this story is not about Iran, not about the United States, not about politics or embassies or spokespeople. It is about children, the ones who live, the ones who die, the ones who are celebrated, the ones who are forgotten. Iran's message, harsh, provocative, unforgettable, was a reminder that every child's life has equal value, even when politics pretends otherwise. And as the world watched a mother cradle her newborn daughter, Iran asked us to remember the mothers who cradle only memory. This is not a story about diplomacy. It is a story about humanity. A story about how a single message, a single sentence, can expose the moral fault lines beneath global power. A story about how joy and grief can collide in the same moment. How a newborn child can become a symbol of a nation's pain. How the world can be reminded, in the simplest of ways, that innocence is universal, and that when one child is born, we must not forget the children who never had the chance. The children of Iran, of Palestine, of Sudan. We should remember those that our weapons killed or helped killing. We should never forget. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC. Okay, let's see. Now, let's talk about Trump's refusal of Iran proposal. According to political analyst Dr. Khaled Al-Tarani, there is a major escalation point between the United States and Iran. Sometimes war doesn't begin with a missile. Sometimes it begins with a sentence, a rejection, a message carried through a mediator, a reply that one side calls unacceptable and the other calls final. Today, we follow a moment the world barely noticed, a moment that could decide whether the Middle East steps back from the edge or falls into the fire again. This is the story of Trump's rejection of Iran's response, and the question that now hangs over the region, will the war return? The story begins not in Washington, not in Tehran, but in Islamabad. A Pakistani mediator carries a message from Iran to the United States. A proposal. A path. Fragile. Narrow. Imperfect. Toward ending the war. Iran submits a 14-point plan. A ceasefire mechanism. A timeline. A framework for de-escalation across multiple fronts, including Lebanon. A diplomatic attempt to stop a region from burning. And then, the reply. Donald Trump looks at the proposal and says two words, completely unacceptable. A door closes, a window slams shut, and the region holds its breath. Trump doesn't just reject the proposal privately. He rejects it publicly, loudly, declaring that the battle is going excellently. It is a message meant for Iran, but also for his base, for his allies, for the world. A message that says the United States is not backing down. The war is not ending. The pressure will continue. But behind the cameras, behind the slogans, behind the bravado, something else is happening. According to Dr. Khaled Al-Tarani, the United States has no real alternative to negotiation, no appetite for a new war, no strategy for escalation. And that contradiction between public defiance and private limitation is where the danger lives. Iran hears Trump's rejection, and it does not explode. It does not retaliate. It does not escalate. Instead, Iran says, "We are waiting for a formal U.S. reply." A sentence that sounds calm, but is loaded with threat. Because Iran's silence is not weakness. It is calculation. Iran knows the region is a chessboard, and it knows the United States is stretched, militarily, politically, diplomatically. So Iran waits, and the world waits with it. So to understand why this moment matters, we need to understand the war behind it. A war that has spilled across borders. A war fought in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, in the Gulf. A war of drones, militias, sanctions, assassinations, and shadow operations. A war that has no front line, because the entire region is the front line. And now, with one rejection, the question returns. So is the war about to reignite? Dr. Khaled Al-Tarani is not a man who speaks in slogans. He speaks in patterns, in structures, in the logic of power. And he says something the world should hear. The United States cannot escalate. Iran will not surrender. And both sides are trapped in a cycle neither can break. This is not a war of choice anymore. It is a war of momentum. A war that continues because no one knows how to stop it. Trump's rejection is not just a diplomatic move. It is a signal to Israel, a signal to the Gulf, a signal to Iran's allies, a signal to the countries watching from the shadows. And every signal in this region has consequences. A drone strike here, a missile launch there, a convoy hit on a desert road, a ship targeted in the Gulf. Each act, small on its own. Together, a fuse.
Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen. Each one a pressure point, each one a trigger, each one a place where a single miscalculation could ignite a regional fire. Iran's 14-point plan tried to address this, to create a mechanism for de-escalation across all fronts. Trump's rejection removes that mechanism. And now, every front is exposed. War is not just fought with weapons. It is fought with politics. Trump's rejection plays well with his base. It projects strength, it projects dominance, it projects control. But projecting strength is not the same as having it. And Al-Tarani warns the United States is negotiating from a position of weakness, not power. A dangerous place to negotiate from. A dangerous place to reject proposals from. A dangerous place to escalate from.
So we arrive at the question, will the war return? The analysts say it depends on miscalculation. The diplomats say it depends on timing. The military say it depends on orders. But the truth is simpler. It depends on whether anyone is willing to step back. And right now, no one is. Trump rejected Iran's reply. Iran is waiting for America's next move. The region is holding its breath. And somewhere, in a war room, in a bunker, in a ministry office, someone is deciding whether the next chapter will be diplomacy or fire. This is not just a political moment. It is a human one. A moment that will shape lives, families, futures. A moment that could decide whether the Middle East steps back from the edge or falls into the abyss. A moment that is happening right now. A moment where Trump is trying to fix an issue that wasn't there to begin with. A moment built on urgency without substance. A crisis manufactured out of thin air. A performance of power aimed at a problem that never existed. And in that performance, you can see the truth. He's fighting shadows, not realities.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and the story is not over.
Okay, now let's go back to occupied land and Hezbollah. Okay, look, sometimes the battlefield changes, not with a tank, not with a missile, not with a speech, but with a sound, a faint buzz in the sky, a shadow that wasn't there yesterday, a machine so small it barely registers on radar, yet powerful enough to rewrite the rules of war. Today, we follow the story of the drones, the Musayyarat, that have forced Israel into a new reality, a reality it cannot control, a reality it cannot stop, a reality it never expected. This is the story of how Hezbollah's drones reshaped the Northern Front and why Israel's army has no answer. For decades, Israel dominated the skies. Jets, helicopters, surveillance balloons, satellites, a full spectrum of aerial supremacy. But then came the drones. Not American drones, not Israeli drones, not state-of-the-art machines with billion-dollar budgets. No, these were different. Small, silent, cheap, precise, persistent. And they began appearing over Israeli positions again and again, until the army realized something terrifying. The sky was no longer theirs.
See, Hezbollah's drones have created a new battlefield reality, a reality Israel cannot reverse. These drones are not symbolic. They are not propaganda tools. They are not toys. They are weapons. They are scouts. They are psychological pressure. They are strategic leverage. And Israel, with all its technology, all its intelligence, all its military power, has no solution. It began with reconnaissance, drones flying low, slow, invisible to radar, filming Israeli bases, mapping movements, recording vulnerabilities. Then came the strikes, a drone dropping a munition on an Israeli outpost, a drone hitting a surveillance tower, a drone targeting a tank, a drone flying directly over a military base, filming everything. Each flight was a message. We see you. We reach you. We are above you. Now, Israel's pride, the Iron Dome, was built for rockets. Fast, high, predictable. But drones? Slow, low, unpredictable. The Iron Dome cannot track them, cannot lock onto them, cannot intercept them. And so Israel is forced to watch, helpless, as drones fly over its positions, record its movements, and strike its soldiers. This is not just a tactical failure, it is a psychological one. Imagine being an Israeli soldier on the northern front. You hear a sound, faint, distant, metallic. You look up, you see a dot in the sky. Is it filming you? Is it armed? Is it about to strike? You don't know. Your commanders don't know. Your army doesn't know. And that uncertainty, that fear, is a weapon.
So you see, Hezbollah's drones are not random. They are part of a strategy to exhaust Israel, expose its weaknesses, force it into a defensive posture, drain its resources, break its confidence, challenge its technological superiority. This is not a war of rockets. It is a war of attrition, a war of patience, a war of pressure. And Israel is feeling it. Israel's army is built on one assumption: superiority. Superiority in the air, superiority in intelligence, superiority in technology. But drones undermine all three. They fly under radar. They gather intelligence Israel cannot stop. They strike targets Israel cannot protect. And so the army finds itself in a position it has not faced in decades. It does not know what to do. So now the north border. Look at the north border. The northern front is no longer a border. It is a laboratory, a place where new tactics are tested, where new weapons are introduced, where new rules are written. And Hezbollah is writing them. Every drone flight is a message. Every strike is a lesson. Every video is a warning. Israel is no longer dictating the terms. It is reacting, defending, absorbing. And that shift from offense to defense is the beginning of strategic decline. So now what about inside the occupied land, or what's called Israel? Inside Israel, the drones have become a political crisis. Families of soldiers demand answers. Politicians argue on television. Generals warn of a new threat. Settlers flee the northern towns. The drones are not just weapons. They are symbols. Symbols of a state losing control. Symbols of an army losing confidence. Symbols of a frontier that is no longer safe. So where does this go? Munir Shahadeh says the drones are only the beginning. More advanced models are coming. Longer range, heavier payloads, smarter navigation, better cameras. The battlefield is evolving, and Israel is struggling to keep up. The question now is not whether drones will shape the war. They already have. The question is, what happens when the next generation arrives? The drones that buzz over the northern front are more than machines. They are signals, warnings, harbingers of a new era. An era where the sky is contested, where technology is democratized, where power is no longer guaranteed. Israel once believed it owned the air. Now it looks up, uncertain. And in that uncertainty, a new battlefield is born. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, where the call for freedom doesn't fade. It burns. It rises. It shines.
Now, let's switch our talk and discuss why AIPAC will fall. Today, we look at a giant, a political machine that shaped American policy for decades, a lobby that presidents feared, candidates obeyed, and Congress rarely challenged, a force so powerful that even whispering its name once felt dangerous. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. For years, it was untouchable. For years, it dictated the boundaries of political speech. For years, it punished anyone who stepped outside the line. But today, something is changing. The ground is shifting. The machine is stalling. The fear is fading. And for the first time in its history, AIPAC is facing a question it never imagined. What happens when the money stops working?
For decades, AIPAC built its power on a simple formula: money, access, punishment. If you supported Israel unconditionally, AIPAC rewarded you. If you questioned Israeli policy, AIPAC targeted you. If you dared to criticize the occupation, AIPAC made an example of you. This was not subtle. This was not hidden. This was the system. And for a long time, it worked. Candidates feared AIPAC. Presidents courted AIPAC. Congress obeyed AIPAC. But power built on fear is fragile. And fear is disappearing. Breaking Points reported something extraordinary. AIPAC spent $20 million trying to defeat a handful of progressive candidates. And it failed. Candidates who openly criticized Israeli policy, candidates AIPAC labeled dangerous, won anyway. This was not supposed to happen. This was not in the script. This was not how the machine worked. But the machine is breaking. Then came New Jersey. AIPAC poured money into the race. They backed their preferred candidate. They mobilized donors, PACs, messaging networks. And they lost. Badly. Analysts called it an earthquake, a political shockwave, a sign that AIPAC's grip on Democratic primaries is slipping. Because money can buy ads, money can buy mailers, money can buy consultants, but money cannot buy a public that has seen Gaza. For years, AIPAC operated in the shadows. Dark money, bundled donations, quiet threats, silent pressure. But now, activists are tracking every dollar. ZTO profiled the organizers behind Track AIPAC, a grassroots movement exposing where AIPAC's money comes from, who it funds, how it influences elections, which candidates take its checks. And once the public sees the money, the spell breaks. AIPAC's greatest weapon was secrecy. That weapon is gone.
AIPAC's model depends on one thing: a silent, obedient political class. But a new generation is rising. Younger, more diverse, more informed, more connected. They have seen Gaza on their phones. They have watched the occupation in real time. They have heard Palestinian voices without filters. And they are not afraid. They are rejecting AIPAC money. They are winning races AIPAC tried to control. They are speaking truths that once ended careers. AIPAC cannot intimidate a generation that has nothing to lose and everything to say. The Majority Report put it plainly. AIPAC is losing its grip on the Democratic Party. Not at the top, not yet, but at the grassroots, at the local level, at the primary level, at the level where political futures are born. Progressive candidates are winning. AIPAC-backed candidates are losing. And the old guard is aging out. This is not a moment. This is a shift.
So, okay, look at this. The English-language international news channel based in Istanbul, Turkey, TRT World, has highlighted something AIPAC cannot control: public opinion. For the first time in modern polling, a majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's actions in Gaza. Younger voters overwhelmingly support Palestinian rights. Even many Jewish Americans are breaking with AIPAC's hardline positions. AIPAC can buy ads. It cannot buy public conscience. And conscience is turning.
AIPAC's power was never just money. It was fear. Fear of being labeled anti-Israel. Fear of being smeared. Fear of losing funding. Fear of losing elections. But today, candidates are saying something AIPAC never expected. Go ahead, attack me. I'm not afraid. And when fear disappears, power collapses.
Let's see. Now, so how will AIPAC fall? Not in a single moment, not in a single election, not in a single scandal. It will fall the way all political machines fall. Through overreach, through arrogance, through misreading the public, through losing touch with the moment, through believing money is enough. AIPAC is fighting yesterday's battles with yesterday's tools in a world that has already moved on, and the world is not coming back. Today, we stand at a turning point. AIPAC is still powerful, still wealthy, still influential, but it is no longer inevitable, no longer untouchable, no longer feared. And once a political machine loses inevitability, it begins to die. Slowly, quietly, then all at once. The fall of AIPAC will not be the end of influence, but it will be the end of silence. Because a new generation is speaking. A new movement is rising. A new political reality is forming. And in that reality, AIPAC is no longer the author of the story. It is a chapter. One that is closing. So where does that lead us? Where does this moment, this political unraveling, this moral reckoning actually take us? Let me tell you what I see. Not as a prophecy, not as a forecast, but as an observation. A long, slow, undeniable shift happening right in front of us. Look at our politicians. Look at the way they bow, bend, and fold themselves into shapes that please AIPAC. Look at the way they treat that lobby as if it were a throne they must kneel before. For decades, aligning with AIPAC was considered smart politics, a shortcut to funding, influence, and protection. But something has changed, something fundamental. I believe, and this is my observation, that we are entering a time when anyone who associates themselves with AIPAC will no longer be seen as powerful, but as compromised. Not respected, but exposed. Not admired, but marked. Marked by the public, marked by history, marked by a generation that is no longer willing to pretend that money is innocence or that influence is virtue. I believe that soon, very soon, the association itself will carry a stain, a political scar, a moral bruise, a sign that says, you took the money, you looked away, you chose the lobby over the people. And when that moment arrives, it will not be subtle. It will not be quiet. It will not be polite. It will be a cultural shift, the kind that rewrites reputations overnight. The kind that turns yesterday's alliances into tomorrow's embarrassments. The kind that makes a whole generation look back at the previous one with disbelief, with disappointment, with disgust. Because let's be honest, the next generation is watching. They are watching everything. They are watching who took the checks, who repeated the talking points, who defended the indefensible, who traded integrity for access, who traded conscience for applause. And they will not forget. They will not forget the politicians who stood on stages and justified suffering. They will not forget the lawmakers who voted for bombs and called it diplomacy. They will not forget the leaders who claimed to care about human rights, except when it came to Palestinians. And when they look back, they will ask, how did you accept that money? How did you take those donations? How did you let a lobby dictate your morality? How did you let influence become a substitute for truth? This is not about left or right. This is not about party or ideology. This is about a moral line. A line that has been crossed too many times for too many years by too many people who thought no one would ever hold them accountable. But accountability is coming. Not from the top, not from the institutions, not from the political class. It's coming from the people, from the streets, from the campuses, from the communities,
from the generation that refuses to inherit silence. And here is my observation, the one that sits heavy in my chest. We are witnessing the end of an era, the end of automatic loyalty, the end of unquestioned alliances, the end of political obedience disguised as patriotism. We are watching a shift in real time, a shift in public consciousness, in moral clarity, in political courage, a shift that is making it harder and harder for politicians to hide behind old narratives, old excuses, old alliances. And yes, I believe we are also watching the end of something else, the era when AIPAC could shape the direction of American politics without challenge, without scrutiny, without consequence. I'm not predicting elections. I'm not naming winners or losers. I'm not forecasting political outcomes. I'm simply telling you what I see. A generation that is done being silent, done being manipulated, done being told what to believe. A generation that is saying no more. Not in our name, not with our future. And that changes everything. Because once a society begins to question the source of its political influence, once it begins to examine the money behind the message, once it begins to expose the machinery behind the policy, the spell breaks. The illusion dissolves. The power shifts. The truth steps into the light.
And when truth steps into the light, it does not step back into the shadows. So here is what I believe. Again, as my observation, my analysis, my reading of the moment. We are living through the unraveling of an old political order. An order built on fear, on silence, on influence, on money. An order that believed it could last forever. An order that never imagined the public would wake up. But the public is awake now. The youth are awake. The world is awake. And once people wake up, they do not go back to sleep. This is not about one politician. This is not about one administration. This is not about one moment in time. This is about a shift in moral gravity, a shift in political consciousness, a shift in what people are willing to accept and what they are no longer willing to tolerate. And that shift is happening right in front of our eyes.
So where does that lead us? It leads us to a future where influence is not immunity, where money is not morality, where lobbies do not dictate conscience, where politicians cannot hide behind the old shields, where the next generation demands accountability and gets it. It leads us to a future where the truth is louder than the checkbook, where justice is louder than the lobby, where the people are louder than the donors. It leads us to a future where the political landscape is rewritten, not by the powerful, but by the principled. And that, right there, is the shift of our time.
Okay. In the near future, I believe we're going to hear something we haven't heard nearly enough of. Apologies. Public apologies. Uneasy apologies. Late apologies. From people who took the money, protected the system, and looked away when it mattered most. You're going to see politicians step forward and admit, some reluctantly, some strategically, that accepting AIPAC money came with a cost. You're going to hear media figures and reporters try to explain their silence, their hesitation, their failure to ask the questions they should have asked long ago. They will say they were cautious. They will say they were pressured. They will say they were afraid of being labeled anti-Israel for simply telling the truth. But history has a way of catching up with cowards. So sit back and watch carefully, because the moment of reckoning is coming. And when it arrives, it won't whisper. It will come in headlines, in interviews, in statements carefully read from podiums, and in voices trying to make peace with what they once refused to confront.
Okay, what's next? Oh, yes, something important I need to get to your attention. Every society has its myths, the stories we tell ourselves about generosity, charity, and the goodness of giving. We want to believe that when we donate, when we hand over our old car or write a check or click a button,
We are helping someone who needs it. We want to believe that charity is simple, pure, honest. But sometimes the story is darker. Sometimes the organizations that promise to help children help themselves instead. Sometimes the jingle that gets stuck in your head is not a symbol of kindness, but a warning you didn't hear. Today, we look at one of the most recognizable charities in America. A charity with a jingle every child can sing. A charity that promised to help kids and was found guilty of misleading millions. This is the story of Cars for Kids and the scandal that exposed what was really happening behind the music.
If you grew up in the United States, you know the song. You heard it on the radio, on TV, in the car, in the background of your life. 1-877-CARS-4-KIDS. Donate your car today. It was catchy. It was everywhere. It was impossible to escape. And that was the point. Cars for Kids built one of the most aggressive advertising campaigns in American nonprofit history. They spent millions to convince people that donating their old car would help kids. No details, no specifics, just kids. And people believed it. Because why wouldn't they? It's a charity. It's for children. It's on every radio station in the country. But behind the jingle was a truth the ads never mentioned.
It started with questions. Donors asked, which kids? Where? What programs? What impact? And the answers didn't come. People discovered their donations weren't helping children in their own communities. Some learned the money wasn't staying in their state at all. Others found out the funds were going to programs they never knew existed, programs the ads never mentioned. The complaints grew. The questions grew louder. And eventually, state investigators stepped in. The turning point came in California. The state's attorney general launched an investigation into Cars for Kids advertising practices. What they found was simple and damning. The ads were misleading. The charity was not transparent. Donors were not told the truth. California ruled that Cars for Kids misled donors about where their money was going, failed to disclose that donations funded religious programs, implied that funds helped local children when they did not, used vague language to hide the true purpose of the charity. The court found Cars for Kids guilty of deceptive advertising. The penalty? Fines, restrictions, and a ban on their ads until they corrected the deception. The jingle went silent in California.
Okay. As journalists dug deeper, another truth emerged. Cars for Kids was not a general children's charity. It was a fundraising arm for URA, an organization that promotes Orthodox Jewish religious education. The money was raised for 17 and 18-year-old children to make trips to Israel, only Jewish children, and only to educate them about the Israeli myth of the Promised Land. The ads never said the money went to religious programs. They never said the funds supported a specific community. They never said donors' cars were not helping all kids, but instead serving a narrow, targeted mission. Transparency is the foundation of charity, and Cars for Kids had none. Investigators found something else. A huge portion of donations, millions of dollars, was spent on advertising itself. The jingle wasn't just a marketing tool, it was the product. The charity used donations to buy more ads, to get more donations, to buy more ads. A cycle, a machine, a business model disguised as charity. And the children donors thought they were helping, they were not receiving the funds. The donations were swallowed by marketing, overhead, and administrative costs.
When the news broke, people were stunned. How could a charity so visible, so familiar, so omnipresent be misleading millions? How could a jingle that felt harmless hide so much? Donors felt betrayed. Communities felt misled. And the public began asking a deeper question. If this charity, the one we all know, was deceptive, how many others are?
the scandal became a national conversation about transparency, accountability, and the ethics of nonprofit advertising. The Cars for Kids case is not just about one organization. It is about the system. A system where charities can spend more on ads than on children. Donors are left in the dark. Vague language replaces real information. Emotional appeals replace transparency. And oversight often comes too late. The scandal exposed a truth many people didn't want to face. Charity is not always charitable. And giving is not always simple.
Behind every donation is a story. A family giving away their old car because they want to help a child. A parent teaching their kids about generosity. A person who doesn't have much but gives anyway. These people were not just misled. They were used. Their kindness became a commodity. Their generosity became a marketing strategy. Their trust became a revenue stream. And that is the real tragedy of the Cars for Kids scandal. Not the fines, not the legal ruling, not the headlines, but the betrayal of good people who wanted to do good. So what happens now? Cars for Kids still exists. The jingle still plays in many states. The charity still collects millions. But the public is different. More skeptical, more informed, more aware. The scandal forced donors to ask questions they should have been asking all along. Where is my money going? Who is it helping? What is the mission? Who benefits? Who decides? Charity must be transparent, because generosity deserves honesty.
Cars for Kids. Donate your car today. Just like that, a scam in the name of children. The Cars for Kids scandal is not just a scam about a charity. It is a story about trust. Trust given freely. Trust exploited. Trust broken. But it is also a reminder. A reminder that generosity is powerful, and that power must be protected. Because when people give, they give from the heart, and the heart deserves truth. I'm Arlene Russell. This is This Week in Palestine. And today, we learn that even the simplest jingle can hide a complicated truth, a myth, and a scam.
Before we close, I want to leave you with a reminder and an invitation. Jonathan Paz. If the name is new to you, it won't be for long. People across Massachusetts have been talking about him, not because of slogans or spectacle, but because of the way he shows up. His supporters describe him as someone who doesn't talk down to people, someone who doesn't stand above the crowd, but in it. Someone you can walk up to, shake hands with, and have a real conversation. Not a performance, not a photo op, but a genuine exchange. They say he listens. No matter your background, your faith, your income, or your story, he listens. And many of his supporters highlight something they see as central to his campaign, that he is running without ties to organizations that could influence his positions. They describe him as independent, unaligned, and focused on the people he hopes to represent. So if you've been hearing his name more and more, that's why. People want it to stay with you.
Jonathan Paz. Remember it. And now the invitation. Come meet him in person at Cafe Yaffa Natick tonight from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The address is 6A Wethersfield Road, Natick, Massachusetts, 01760. Ask your questions, share your concerns, have a conversation, or simply sit down with a cup of tea and see for yourself. I'll be there too. Let's stand together for what's right. Let's stand together for what we believe in. Let's stand together with Jonathan Paz.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast,
The soft dimming of a candle, the quiet settling of dust after a long, honest conversation. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to dim, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that so often tries to smother it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour rooted in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not vanish when the headlines shift or when the cameras look away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or opened a door you didn't know was there, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine or TWIP and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Palestine Hora.
She's old, with ribbons in her hair, laughing with joy, looking outside from her bedroom window. Mama, when the war is done, can I go play outside again? But the tanks kept rolling in. Can I go play outside again? Mama, I wanna go outside again. Trapped in the car, the siren screamed. Her cousins lay still to children's dreams. Hello, is anyone there? Please don't leave me alone. But the world just heard a tone. Oh, hen, little angel, your voice still flies through the smoke and the ruins, through the world's cries. They said they'd come, but no one came. Just static.
No sirens, no saviors, just guns and